Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The guy who blew the whistle on UBS gets a $104 million award. He's also a felon. U.S. manufacturing needs workers, but how do you teach a whole new skill set and fast? And journalist Bob Woodward on Obama, leadership, and what he'd ask if he were moderating the presidential debates. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, September 11th. Good to have you with us. When Bradley Birkenfeld blew the whistle on the Swiss bank UBS nearly 5 years ago, he helped topple the legendary wall of secrecy around that country's banking system. He also exposed thousands of wealthy Americans hiding their riches overseas. Well, today, he got a big thank you gift from the Internal Revenue Service, a $104 million award, his share of the fine UBS paid to the government. It's thought to be the biggest award to an individual whistleblower in the U.S. ever. Marketplace's senior business correspondent Bob Moon has our story.
What a difference a few years can make. Bradley Birkenfeld started out the year in 2010 reporting to a federal prison where he'd been sentenced to 40 months for helping a wealthy UBS client avoid taxes. He complained at the time that the Justice Department had turned on him, even as he was blowing the whistle on thousands of tax cheats.
This was the largest tax fraud case in the world, and I sacrificed my reputation, my life, my finances, and this is how I get treated?
Today, his attorneys announced he's ultimately been treated to the biggest reward so far under a federal whistleblower program. It was revamped by Congress in 2006 to encourage ratting out tax cheats. One of his lawyers, Stephen Cohn, told a news conference today that even if Birkenfeld was involved in the criminal activity, he deserves the huge payout.
To get the big fish, to get into the conspiracy itself, you have to induce someone who's there at the table.
Cohn says the inside information Birkenfeld provided on the tax evasion scheme has helped the IRS recover up to $5 billion tax dollars. The lawyers say he's a hero who ought to receive a presidential pardon, especially since nobody else went to prison in the case. Birkenfeld was recently freed and is under home confinement. Iowa Senator Charles Grassley, who helped author the generous rewards program, hopes this will blaze the path for future whistleblowers, but he complains this is only the first big payout, and he says the tax man needs to be more aggressive in pursuing close to 1,000 pending whistleblower tips.
Do you guys down at IRS know that you wouldn't even know about this if you hadn't had whistleblowers come forth with the information?
This is just part of a new government emphasis on whistleblower rewards, which also extends to Wall Street traders and government contractors. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Stocks bounce back today. Details when we do the numbers. Bob Woodward knows a thing or two about Washington, D.C. He's been writing about politics and power since the 70s, when he and Carl Bernstein broke the Watergate story. His latest book, his 17th, takes the reader inside the Obama White House during last summer's debt ceiling crisis. Yes, the one that almost swept the country and the markets into economic meltdown. The book is called The Price of Politics. Mr. Woodward, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Talk about President Obama for a minute, because the overall picture that readers will get, I think, from your book is a president who is overly confident, who's sort of a clumsy negotiator, and who doesn't really like Congress that much and doesn't really want to deal with them. Is that the impression you wanted to leave the reader with?
Well, what I've done is reported that, Larry Summers, he was Obama's chief economic advisor in the White House for the first 2 years, and Summers concluded that not only was there this disconnect that Obama had with people, but that in terms of the leaders in Congress, he really didn't like them. And it's quite evident that he doesn't spend enough time with them so they can negotiate.
You've covered a lot of presidents. How different is this White House than the ones you've written about before?
Well, first of all, and you've got to understand, and I think this is critical, that Obama wants to solve these problems. He is a reformer at heart, I would argue. In lots of moments, he tells people he's a fiscal conservative, a so-called blue dog, meaning he's somebody who wants to balance the budget. He told me he would, and this is a quote, he said, "I would willingly lose an election if I could solve this problem of the federal debt and deficit in the right way, in a way that would be long-lasting."
House Speaker John Boehner just said today that he wasn't confident at all that Washington would be able to avoid the looming fiscal cliff that may happen in January. What do you think? Do Americans have any reason for optimism that we can avoid that?
Quite frankly, I'll answer your question. I think it's kind of shocking that this isn't discussed in the presidential campaign. It's probably the most important piece of business. The new president, whoever it is, whether it's Obama or Romney, they are going to face this. They're going to have to do something about it. And we can't have more wreckage. Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, points out in one of the discussions, you can shut down the government, but if we default on our debt, you shut down the American economy. So that's pessimistic. But it's fixable also.
You mentioned that the candidates are not talking on the campaign trail about this looming fiscal cliff. Why do you think that's so? Why aren't they talking about it?
In a sense, it's kind of like, I guess people think it's complicated. People think it's abstract. If I were moderating one of those debates, I would ask many questions about this and say, what are you going to do? What's your theory of the case?
I've got to ask you, I'm sure you've read some of the reviews of your book, and some of them are saying, well, there's nothing that new here. We've read a lot of this before. What do you say to those people?
Well, that they reviewed the book and didn't read it. No one interviewed the president other than myself on these topics in depth, and to suggest that it's new or not new is ridiculous.
So finally, this is your 17th book. What's your 18th going to be about?
Don't have a plan. I hope it's not.
No plan.
I hope it's not about, you know, the politicians in Washington finally sunk the ship.
Yeah. Bob Woodward's new book goes on sale today. It's called The Price of Politics. Mr. Woodward, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And if you want to hear more of that interview, just go to our website, marketplace.org. U.S. manufacturing has been on a seesaw this year, up for the first 5 months, but it's fallen since June. Part of the problem? We're exporting less to a struggling Europe, and that showed up in trade deficit numbers out today. Still, some American companies are opening and reopening factories in the U.S., and many of the jobs require a whole new skill set, something someone who worked in a factory 5, maybe 10 years ago probably doesn't have. In North Carolina, community colleges are trying to fix that. Marketplace's David Gura has the story.
Since the economic downturn, many traditional manufacturers in North Carolina, furniture factories and textile mills, have closed down. So many of the unemployed here have turned to the state's 58 community colleges for help with retraining. Gary Green is the president of Forsyth Tech in Winston-Salem.
It's a challenge, but it's an opportunity for community colleges to step up at a time when people are really struggling in the job market, to step up and try to give them the skills they need to make the transition to what is the new economy.
In North Carolina, that economy centers on what's called advanced manufacturing, and successful job seekers need to know more about computers than assembly lines. When I visited Forsyth Tech, the lobby was packed. Students were registering for classes. Enrollment is up 43% since 2006. Last year, almost 13,000 students took courses for credit. Eric Hanks was one of them. He enrolled in the school's nanotechnology program after he lost his job 3 years ago. He worked in IT for more than a decade.
Everybody I've met is a little bit different, has a little bit different circumstance. But it all boils down to we need retraining for a different field.
North Carolina's community colleges have been nimble. Administrators have worked with local companies to make sure students learn skills that'll make them more employable. Eric Hanks is hopeful he'll land a job. There are big research universities nearby, magnets for high-tech companies. But outside North Carolina cities, the picture changes. 1 hour west of Winston-Salem, rural Wilkes County is nestled in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and unemployment here is above 11%. Like Forsyth Tech, Wilkes Community College works with local companies. There just aren't as many of them here as there are in Winston-Salem. Lyndall Duvall heads Wilkes Community College's Applied Engineering Technologies program.
I think our role is to make sure that as the advanced manufacturing expands out along the interstates and back into the rural communities, that we're ready when they get here with a skilled workforce that can support those types of industries.
But the factories that are still here need workers who can run and repair new machines. John Souther used to work in furniture, doing what he calls unskilled labor. Then he was a long-haul trucker. And after 11 years, he got laid off.
You either went back to school or you just couldn't find a job. There's still not a great abundance of jobs in Wilkes County.
Souther, like other students at Wilkes Community College, learned what Lyndall Duvall calls a little bit of everything to increase their odds of getting a job. John Souther did eventually get one with Tyson Foods, maintaining equipment at a chicken processing plant. Tyson is the biggest employer around here. It's not alternative energy, the field Souther wants to work in, but it's a good job, and he says he couldn't have gotten it if he hadn't gone back to school. In Wilkesboro, North Carolina, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Coming up,
things like Occupy Wall Street make it less okay to be carrying the high-end bags.
Has the weak economy finally put a crimp in luxury goods? First, let's do the numbers. It was a wait-and-see kind of a day on Wall Street as traders pondered whether the Fed will or won't pour on more financial stimulus. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 69 points, 0.5%, closing at 13,323, a small gain, but still it pushed the blue chips higher than they've been in almost 5 years. The NASDAQ barely budged, tacking on just a 0.5 point and basically ending the same place it started at 3104. The S&P 500 added just 4 points, a 0.3%, finishing at 1433. Everybody wants to see more jobs, but Wall Street also values efficiency. So when it comes to deeper job cuts at struggling Hewlett-Packard, investors treated that as good news. The stock gained 3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.70%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve begins a two-day meeting on the economy and interest rates. The Senate Environment and Public Works Committee discusses nuclear reactor safety in the 21st century. And on September 12, 1978, the sitcom Taxi began its five-year ride on television. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Ryssdal. This September 11th, 11 years after the World Trade Center attacks, at least one big lawsuit is still unsettled. At issue, the airlines and whether they're on the hook for lax security the morning of the attacks. The accuser, the developer of the Twin Towers, who wants nearly $3 billion. Marketplace's Scott Tong has the story.
The plaintiff is Larry Silverstein, the high-profile developer of the World Trade Center. He's suing United and American Airlines for lax security, arguing they bear responsibility for his property damage. Remember, this happened before the TSA pat-downs. The airlines did security. And aviation lawyer Robert Clifford says back then, they outsourced and they skimped.
We ultimately knew that we had checkpoint security people who were making less money than the folks down the terminal who were flipping burgers.
Airlines have been sued before for terror acts. Family members of victims on Lockerbie Flight 103 sued Pan Am, and they won. So, attorney Mike Danko says Larry Silverstein has precedent.
It's not kind of wild and crazy. He's taking a lot of heat in the press, but this is not particularly novel. What is unusual is that he is a property owner rather than a family member of a passenger.
Most 9/11 families didn't go after the airlines because the government set up a special fund for them. Today, of course, the federal TSA runs the metal detectors, and Danko argues it's less accountable.
The federal government is entitled to sovereign immunity. Basically, well, going back hundreds of years, the thought was you couldn't sue the king. And so now you can't sue the federal government unless the federal government says, yes, it's okay to sue us.
So in the end, after investigations into terrorism and intelligence failings, it's the airlines that could go to trial. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, Germany's High Court will rule on a request to block the country's participation in the Eurozone bailout fund. Specifically, is it constitutional? If the court says nein, that spells trouble for the European Central Bank's huge new bond-buying program announced last week, the one aimed at saving the euro and stemming the debt crisis. So, big doings in Europe means it must be time for...
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
Martina Stevis is the EU economics reporter for Dow Jones. She has some insight into whether that big bond buying plan is big enough. Martina, good to have you back with us.
Pleasure to be back.
Now, you know, the European stock markets were really cheering the plan last week, but the devil is in the details.
Exactly. The European Central Bank announced a program last week that really calmed markets. It's also showing very strongly in the exchange rate between the euro and the dollar. That's really been recovering over the last few days. And I can tell you it's definitely affected the mood of people here in Brussels, policymakers, bureaucrats at the European Commission, even journalists are smiling. I haven't seen them smile in months. But the question really is, is it enough and is it too late? The ECB is buying time. Will the Eurozone and the troubled countries be able to do what they have to do in that time that has been afforded to them?
Yeah. Speaking of troubled countries, I understand that you are just back from your vacation in Greece. You've got family there. Tell us about conversations you had with your friends and family. How are they feeling? Are they feeling more optimistic since this plan came out, less?
They are certainly been feeling more optimistic over the last week. And, you know, mind you, Greece is just, it's a wonderful summer destination. So the sun and the sea and the food do tend to take the edge off the bad emotions. That said, it's always important to remind listeners that the country is in its fifth consecutive year of recession. And it's really suffering in terms of unemployment, which is edging towards 24%,
wow,
more than 50% among youth. So the pain is really felt on the ground.
Martina Stevis is the EU economics reporter for Dow Jones. Martina, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Healthcare has become one of the biggest and most contentious issues in the presidential election. Obama's running on his reforms. Mitt Romney is running against them. The two men don't agree on much, except that something needs to be done to bring down costs. And if the past is any indication, it's not going to be easy. Before Congress passed the new law expanding health insurance, Massachusetts did it when Romney was governor. Today, 98% of residents there are insured. And Massachusetts has the highest per capita healthcare spending in the nation. From New Hampshire Public Radio, Dan Gorenstein reports.
There's this persistent myth about health reform that's pretty common, even in health policy circles.
If we could just give everybody health insurance, somehow we would save billions and billions of dollars.
That's Harvard public health professor Ashish Jha.
It turns out, empirically, it's just not true.
If anything, the health reform experiment here has proven insurance doesn't equal savings.
I always say if the goal is to save money on healthcare, the best way to do it is to just deny everybody healthcare.
Jha says the secret about giving people health insurance? They use it. Folks who had held off going to the doctor, scared for their wallets, now are making appointments. So spending continues to rise 4 to 7% a year. Everyone agrees that's unsustainable. And in Massachusetts now, it's against the law. This summer, legislators passed a plan that says healthcare costs can grow no faster than the state's economy. That means healthcare increases must be cut roughly in half. But even before the legislation took effect, insurers, hospitals, and doctors were on the sacred quest to save money.
It's great to make people healthy. It's really spectacular to make people healthy and save money at the same time.
Dr. David Elvin and the team at the Cambridge Health Alliance Hospital Group have targeted their 400 sickest and most expensive Medicaid patients.
We're talking about patients that inexplicably seem to be costing a lot of money and are clearly not getting better.
Like this one woman with diabetes.
Her numbers, they were just getting worse and worse and worse.
Elvin dispatched his staff to investigate, and after digging into this woman's life a little, they found out
this person's child, adult child, was stealing her medications and selling them. And each month, she just promised herself that she would keep the medicine safe. And each month, he would come into her home and rob her.
At that point, Elvin says his staff did something unusual.
We accompanied her to court and got a restraining order.
The patient held on to her meds, got better, costs fell. Elvin says he's got lots of stories like this, which is why the new program is on track to reduce spending by 3%. He says, here's the lesson. If doctors really want to bend the cost curve, they've got to address whatever gets in the way of their patients getting good care. The state's top insurance companies are also changing the way they operate to save money. Doug Thompson works with Elvin on the business side. He says there's a growing move among insurers to give doctors and hospitals a lump of money, say $5 million to manage 1,000 patients a year.
More and more here in Massachusetts, each patient will be part of a budget.
And that means questioning every test, every procedure, every prescription.
And we'll need to manage those resources even more than we did in the past.
Under these deals, the more the docs save, the more they make. And if patient health improves, bonuses kick in. If they go over budget, doctors and hospitals may owe the insurance company money. That's why guys like Gene Muse have become a hot commodity.
I'm a licensed pharmacist in Massachusetts.
Muse works for a group of doctors, the Mount Auburn-Cambridge Independent Practice Association. They call it MACIPA. He's the guy who keeps the drug costs down.
I look at the drugs that are available. I look at what those drugs cost. And what I do is I provide that information to our physicians so that we can make a choice on what drug is best for the patient.
Dr. Barbara Spivak is president of MACIPA.
I have a patient who has 18 different problems and 25 different medicines. If you look at one of the most common reasons why people get sick, it's because of confusion about their pills.
These new contracts are forcing doctors to make tough decisions about the things that they do every day, and it appears to be working. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, the state's largest insurer, says it reduced costs by more than 3% last year. The Blue's Dana Safran says numbers like that means matching spending increases to inflation is within reach.
We have to get healthcare spending growth to look more like the rest of the economy so that healthcare isn't eating everybody else's lunch.
Safran says health reform 1.0, getting everybody insurance, is in the rearview mirror. Health reform 2.0, solving out-of-whack cost increases, that's still a long road ahead. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
A sales warning today from British luxury brand Burberry, you know, those expensive beige and red plaid handbags and overcoats. Even in the recession, wealthy consumers have helped keep high-end retailers like Burberry and Gucci in the black. Now, one label's warning does not a luxury sales crisis make, but there may be cause for wider anxiety, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
I'm a hat guy. Just bought a classic Stetson fedora for $48. But what I really have my eye on?
Borsellino probably is going to run about $375.
Wow. And you're still selling some of them?
We are still selling some of them.
Louise Marriage is the manager of Helmer's Haberdashers in downtown Portland.
Certainly not the same as we were like probably 10 years ago. But there are those that is what they want.
In fact, the wealth of the wealthy has been surprisingly resilient through the recession, says NYU economist Ed Wolf.
They did suffer about a 14% decline in their net worth, but the middle class suffered about a 48% decline. Moving forward to 2012, very likely that the rich have recovered where they were.
And this has been reflected in their high-end luxury spending. Retail analyst Patty Edwards says the trouble for brands like Burberry isn't primarily from wealthy U.S. buyers.
The companies that are reporting softer sales have been relying on overseas growth.
China's economy has slowed, and its upper-class tourists may not be filling their new Burberry bags with as much stuff from Saks Fifth Avenue. Edwards thinks if American luxury consumers are holding back, it's about politics, not home, or should I say mansion, economics.
Things like Occupy Wall Street make it less okay to be carrying the high-end bags.
Ed Wolf says if Americans do reduce conspicuous consumption, it could dampen economic growth. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And finally today, word that Royal Caribbean and Mattel are partnering on a new cruise experience. Starting in January, they'll be rolling out a Barbie cruise. For $349 a person, you get a Barbie-decorated stateroom, tea parties, fashion shows, a Barbie mermaid dance class, and more. Mattel calls Barbie a lifestyle brand. Who knew? No word yet as to whether the Barbie cruise experience involves Ken as well. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 69 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ closed virtually flat, and the S&P 500 tacked on 4 points, 0.3%. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Mary Dew, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Haas and Rod Abid. I'm Sarah Gardner. Hope you can join us tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.